This is the KPDC Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we bring you two important stories. First, as the U.S. Census Bureau struggles to overcome the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic and the political maneuverings seemingly aimed at hampering its mission, KPTZ's Chris Bricker recently spoke with the 2020 Census Jefferson County Project Director Jeannie McMacken and Jefferson County Commissioner Greg Brotherton about the logistics, the challenges, and the successes that good planning have brought to our county's efforts. Both emphasize convincingly the importance of being counted before October 31st. And then we catch up with the board president of an amazing volunteer organization that is seeking to expand its mission to help foster children and their families at a time of most urgent need. So now let's go inside the Compass.
This year, our nation's changing demography and its count remains in the balance as the Census Bureau struggles to overcome the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. That enough would be a big challenge, but add the Trump administration's overtures seeking to remove undocumented immigrants from the count, illegal aliens, as the administration's memo's words say. That was in July, and then in August, the Census Bureau announcing that they would be cutting short the headcount by a month. Reapportionment of the House of Representatives among states would be the result of the former, and both changes would result in an undercount of demographic groups. A region's ability to serve its citizens and work for the common good also lie in the balance. Enter our champions of the census here in Jefferson County. They and their volunteers and enumerators have huddled, regrouped, and move forward with amazing dedication under a morphing deadline and less than optimum circumstances. KPTZ welcomes Greg Brotherton, Jefferson County's District 3 Commissioner, along with Jeannie McMacken, the 2020 Census Jefferson County Project Director, in a conversation about the ins and outs and arounds of the 2020 Census. Jeannie and Greg, welcome to KPTZ.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
It's probably best to do an overview for our listeners of how the census works, and then some background and logistics leading up to now. So let's have it.
You want to lead it off, Jeannie?
Sure. Well, I can start out with some news because I think the news will kind of inform the rest of the conversation. On Friday, at the beginning of the Labor Day weekend, a temporary restraining order was granted by U.S. District Court Judge Lucy Coe of Northern California. She blocked the Census Bureau from shortening that data collection timeframe, and a hearing is scheduled for September 17th. Plaintiffs, this is really interesting. Plaintiffs were a wide range, including the National Urban League, King County, then Los Angeles and Chicago, the NAACP, the Navajo Nation, and the League of Women Voters. They sued the Department of Commerce, the Census Bureau, and their directors for violations of something called the Enumeration Clause and Procedure Act. The case addresses four irreparable harm issues. Number one, shortening the time frame will cause an inaccurate apportionment that violates the constitutional right to political representation. They risk losing important federal funding from undercounting. They need to expend additional resources to mitigate undercounting, and the plaintiff's costs will increase because they rely on accurate granular census data to deploy services and allocate capital. And because it's the decennial census, an inaccurate count can't be remedied for another 10 years. So that affects the distribution of federal and state funding, services, and everything for a decade. The reason for cutting the count short in a pandemic when the count was stopped for 3 months earlier this year was mainly to get the numbers on the president's desk by December 31st. That's the background. And right now, everything that we've been told from our local census people is that we continue on until October 31st. And so it's all hands on deck at this point.
Well, you know, I was thinking as you were kind of giving us this background here and the latest wrinkle in, well, it's not a wrinkle. I think it's an advantage for the people that are actually doing the census. But also, I'm thinking, that's 10 years. That's generational. That has a huge impact. What are some of the impacts of an accurate or an inaccurate count in the census?
We did some calculations to approximate $2,300 for every citizen of Jefferson County, kind of comes to Jefferson County because of the census, you know, aside from the districting and the apportionment, you know, not just District 1, 2, and 3 in Jefferson County, but our congressional representation and our state representation as well. But the programs that benefit, I mean, I'm the OLECAP chair right now, and, you know, everything from low-income energy assistance to the food that comes into our food banks, these things are all directly inputted by the population that comes from the census. So, you know, as well as being our constitutional obligation, it really feeds the county and it houses the county and it takes care of the most marginalized. So it's really critical. And I do want to say that we're doing a great job right now. You know, we over the last census 10 years ago, I think Jefferson County's rate is, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeannie, but over 10% higher and the best improvement around the state of Washington in our self-reporting to the census. So we're doing a great job, but realizing all these impediments that we have, both with the pandemic and the shortened timeline, you know, we want to keep amplifying that, you know, get on the internet or fill out and mail it in. But we the more self-reporting we do, the more accurate our representation will be going forward, as you say, for the next decade.
Jeannie, how does this work? How does all of this work? People hear the word census, but what does it mean? What are the logistics behind all that?
On April 1st, wherever you were, that's where you were counted. And Census Bureau sent out information the end of February, right during pandemic time, to encourage people to do the census. We had a big campaign in Jefferson County. We asked people kindly to please fill out their forms and sent them in. And the people who did not do that were then sent a mail form to do it by mail. Or some people actually called the toll-free number, which was really nice. We kept track of this pretty closely, Greg, myself, and our complete count committee, and we knew exactly what we needed to do and who we needed to talk to. So we targeted different areas with messaging. And as an aside, this is the first time that the census was focused on an online response. As we all know, Jefferson County doesn't have the best internet connections, and we felt that taking the message to the people in various ways was the right thing to do. So we started getting really great response, and we started doing follow-up. I can tell you that we've had several mobile questionnaire assistance pop-ups. Employees of the Census Bureau have been working locations all around the county. We've been in Brennan and Quilcene and Hadlock and Port Townsend at food banks and community centers. We're investigating doing something at the Jefferson Museum of Art History. Allison Arthur from OLECAP has been a big help. She's been at these. Greg has shown up and in his wonderful way has really explained the census very well to so many people. And we've been giving away masks and hand sanitizer and water bottles and everything you can think of. You know, we've had good conversations with people, and I think they're finally understanding that, as you said, Chris, it is a 10-year thing. And people who are 15 years old are going to be 25 next time. You know, they're going to be really in that age group where, you know, assistance is really important to everybody. And being counted is so important for so many reasons that Greg explained. We right now have a tribe of census takers, enumerators, that are fanned out all throughout the county, and they've been knocking on doors and getting people to remind them that, yeah, you know, you should do this. It'll take 5 minutes. Let's do it right now. And the reports that I've gotten back are they've done very, very well. As a matter of fact, I've been told, I don't know how to verify any of this information other than it came from the Census Bureau, but 71.5% of households in Jefferson County have self-responded, and another 24.7% have been enumerated. So that means that 96.2% of Jefferson County has been enumerated. I don't know about those numbers, but I do know about the 71.5. And I think that we'll just wait and see in another few weeks. The bad news for us is that they don't break it down by county. So I can't go in and say this particular census tract, the enumerators, I don't know how many of them are out there, you know, say in Brennan. So I don't know how many are being counted down there. We've got the place covered. Let's just put it that way.
The experiences or fears that our shadow community has in the county, how much confidence have we been able to instill in being able to count some of our less fortunate folks out there that may be put off a little bit by the smoke that's been blown by the administration?
I can speak to that a little bit, Chris. I did go down to Brennan to the food bank once and spent a couple hours with the enumerators down there and had lots of great conversations. And one person who was pretty hesitant to do it, his name was Nathaniel. You know, we spoke about a couple issues that affect the county. He was, you know, relying on public transportation and was frustrated with some of the cutbacks we've had to transit's operation down there. And we had a great conversation about that after he had said that he wasn't really interested in doing the census, that he didn't want to be controlled. And in talking to him, I said, you know, the representation, the conversation that we're having right now is facilitated by this census, that it's, you know, connection to your elected officials, even on as small of a level as we were doing, is the kind of thing that the census makes possible. And just connecting the dots for that one individual, he filled out the census and did his part to make sure that we get fully counted. So I think communication is always important, and there's a lot of polarizing rhetoric out there and a lot of truthiness that we have to combat with facts sometimes. But I think if we are compassionate and just explain the relationship between standing up and being counted and services and representation, that usually people come around.
What's been the experience with our Latinx community, our folks that are out there that might live in multiple households and might be reticent to respond to the census?
I know that all the enumerators that I worked with were bilingual and had Spanish as well, but I don't know. Can you speak to that, Jeannie?
I know that bilingual is important. They're out there. I don't have a personal experience with that. I can tell you that they have been doing multifamily household counts, and they've also, the homeless count is now scheduled to take place between the 22nd and 24th of September. It may be extended because of this new deadline. We are part of Olympia, and our Olympia group has been, believe me, I'm pretty tenacious, and I ask people what I want them to do, and I'm pretty persuasive sometimes. And I've really asked them to help us get the best count that we can. And so I think because we have done so well, we are kind of a little shining star here in Washington. You know, we don't want to tarnish it. We want to keep it as bright as possible. So we're asking for lots of help and we're getting it, which is really wonderful.
Like we said a couple of times during our conversation, this has consequences for the nation, especially for its youth and underserved population. And we're hoping that the efforts that you and Greg and your volunteers and staff have put forward in Jefferson County can be an example for some of the wonderful things that can happen when we put our minds to it. And I want to thank you both for joining me today on KPTC.
You're very welcome. I just want to make sure that everybody knows how to do the census.
That's right.
If they haven't done it, they can go to www.2020census.gov and click the Respond Now button. Or they can call 844-330-2020.
Can I make one other quick plug, Chris?
Absolutely, Greg.
You know, Department of Commerce, the State Department of Commerce, has a great new broadband map that is kind of a live map filled by a survey. And everyone that has frustrating internet should pick a time of just takes 2 minutes to fill out the survey at commerce.wa.gov. It'll just sense where you are and sense your bandwidth. And the more people we get to do that, the same way with the census, the more people that are counted, the better case that we can make for broadband infrastructure dollars from outside our county.
I think we have plans to get back together after the fact to see how this all spilled out. And so I'm looking forward to that conversation too. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Regular Compass listeners may remember an interview we did this spring with Morgan and Ian Hanna, a remarkable local couple at the heart of a new core of Peninsula volunteers calling themselves Olympic Angels, who have taken up the cause of providing foster families with the kind of support, love, and mentorship that has been shown in other cities to dramatically improve outcomes not only for foster children, but for entire foster families. Since that time, Olympic Angels in Port Townsend has been bent upon a program of expansion to help foster families at a time of greater need. I caught up with Olympic Angels board president Ian Hanna a few days ago and asked him how Olympic Angels has been faring during the pandemic.
Well, Angels has actually been doing really well. We've added something like 35 new volunteers, so serving more families, more children. Obviously, we have to serve them somewhat differently with distancing and all. But, fostering is harder than ever right now, quite frankly, when most of the services that foster families rely on to help kind of buffer the intensity of the job they have, when those are shut down or constrained, it's just doubly difficult. So having the relief valve of a group of volunteers that in effect serves as a proxy extended family, it makes all the difference in the world. And you know, on average, families in our program get over 50 hours of volunteer time a month. So you can imagine if someone was helping you out 50 hours a month, what a difference it would make in your life. It means a lot. And if we'd have known the pandemic was coming and we could have set up a model to ensure more resilience for foster families, we would have done exactly what we did. And that's why we want to keep growing this program as quickly as possible.
You were really just beginning when the pandemic came along in Port Townsend, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've been programming since March of 2019 with the help of Seattle Angels. They kind of umbrellaed us before we became an entity. But yes, our entity creation was literally in January, basically the first of the year. So we are very, very new as an entity, but, you know, we have a year and a half of actually running the program under our belt.
So for those who may not have heard our original Compass piece on Olympic Angels, why don't you just briefly tell me what Olympic Angels is and what we're talking about here?
Olympic Angels is a nonprofit, part of a national organization called National Angels that has chapters in 22 major metropolitan areas. We're the only really rural chapter in the Angels system, and it all started in Austin about 10 years ago. And it's a very simple program model. All Angels does, Angels only does one thing. We recruit, vet, train, match, and support volunteers to take on the good work of supporting foster families, and in particular, the children in foster care. And we do that through two different programs. One is called Love Box, and Love Box is basically a whole family care. So a group of volunteers will be making sure that the foster mom has everything she needs to be successful, the foster dad has everything he needs to be successful, that any biological kids have what they need to be happy and sound. But most importantly, that someone in that group is ensuring that they are developing a really deep, affirming, authentic relationship with the child in care, so that if they go somewhere else, there's someone that's really watching out for them as their advocate and their friend. And all the literature tells us that's the single most important thing for ensuring kids in care don't go off the rails, that they don't end up homeless or incarcerated or pregnant too early or addicted, all the things that typically happen. So that's really the primary focus in the context of whole family care. So that's Love Box. The community groups are often already somehow affiliated, a group of golf buddies, a book club, people from a business, what have you. And then the second program is called Dare to Dream. It's a teen mentorship program. So for kids that are beginning to approach aging out of foster care, it's really about getting them ready for life as an independent adult. So it's all about 10 very fundamental milestones of getting a driver's license, graduating from high school, knowing how to apply for a job, having a plan for when you age out of care, things like that. And that's literally all we do. It's very, very simple, very, very elemental, and really just making sure that every kid has their someone.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about how the program has grown since the last we spoke? I think it was March, or I can't remember exactly when we spoke.
Yeah. So right, kind of as COVID was really hitting. Yeah. So that number I gave you a moment ago, I think we've added somewhere in the mid-30s in terms of volunteers. I'm not quite sure how many additional kids we've been serving in that time, but you know, COVID has not constrained our growth, because I think there's a really strong recognition of how hard this time is for so many people, particularly people on the margins, and there's nobody more on the margins than kids in foster care. So there's a lot of people really rising up and want to do good things. I think the big challenge for Angels is that we are at our max currently in terms of our case management capacity. So you know, I definitely want to talk about our annual campaign and our desire to add more of that capacity. We want to really, you know, add another case manager as quickly as possible. And that's why I reached out to you in the first place. So, you know, the growth continues apace. We've got great support, you know, from county government, from city government, from the Department of Children, Youth and Families, some of our other institutions here in town that are doing such a great job, the Guardian Ad Litem program, Foster Supports of Jefferson County, Jumping Mouse, Dove House. You know, all these organizations are concerned about the well-being of kids in care. I think, you know, we look at this program as kind of the linchpin. If you're a kid in care and you don't have an advocate that can stay with you for the long haul, you're kind of on your own. And that's an immoral thing to ask of a young child. So it's putting family or proxy family back into the equation.
So about how many foster kids do we have locally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are really two populations to think about. One is the population of kids that are in the dependency system. So, you know, they're going through potential removal from their family. And that typically numbers in Jefferson County between 30 and 40 at any given time. We're very fortunate in Jefferson County that every single one of those kids has what's called a guardian ad litem or a CASA volunteer, meaning that they are a court-appointed special advocate that is the eyes and ears of the judge in making determinations for that case. But those volunteers have a very explicit mission. They are part of the dependency case while it's happening, but then they can have no further contact with the child. So we're very fortunate to have that. That population is sort of discrete and what most people think of when they think of foster care, but there's actually a much larger population beyond that. And this is kids that are in kinship or guardianship care, so they were fortunate enough to have a relative or a family friend that could take them in, and they're not necessarily going into the court system. And you know, there's overlap between those two populations. It's not black and white. Angel serves both populations, and the second population is much larger. We don't actually know how big it is because we don't have those metrics publicly available, but we estimate it somewhere around three times as large. So based on those assumptions, you can figure there are somewhere between 120, maybe 150 foster kids, quote, quote, in Jefferson County.
And about how many of those kids are you now serving?
Right now we are serving, I believe, 33.
I see. So there's a lot of like room for expansion there. So why don't you tell me briefly, we're going to have, this is going to be a sort of shorter segment than the last time, and we're going to run out of time here. So why don't you tell me what your goals are and how people can help?
You bet. Thank you, Steve. I should also mention we are just beginning to serve in Clallam, and that's that's part of this capacity issue. We want to add a case manager in Clallam next year, so we're really focused on both counties in the long run. So where we want to go is basically doubling the number of kids receiving this service in 2021. So go from the low 30s to the mid 60s in terms of kids served. That's going to require doubling the number of volunteers. Right now we have about 85, so we'll need another 80 or 90. And what that boils down to is capacity. We have a working board that's working their tails off to grow the, to organization build. But when it comes to the program delivery, we really need that to be professionalized and sustainable, long-term staffing. So that's what our annual campaign is all about. That has started about a week ago. It's called Who's Your Someone? And you can go to our website, olympicangels.org/someone, and basically read all about it. The idea is that many of us have had someone in our life other than our parents that was instrumental in who we've become. And we are on our social media pages, on our Facebook page, on our Instagram page, people are posting profiles of who their someone was. My someone was a friend of the family, Peter Olive, who came into our family shortly after my eldest sister died and kind of became a surrogate older brother from the age of 9. I think he was in his early 20s. And, we talk every week. He's like a member of the family. And that's meant an enormous amount to my own upbringing. So people are creating these profiles, telling these stories, and then reflecting that back to the fact that most kids in care don't have their someone, and how important that is, because that's really the root of what Angels work is all about.
Well, great. That was very nice and concisely said and done, because we have basically just run out of time.
Well, Steve, I so appreciate you taking the time today. I can't be more thankful to have KPTZ and just have the ability to get this out in the community.
With Board President Ian Hama of Olympic Angels, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker and Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.